Mr. Mirabello, I've seen increasing interest among non-resident aliens in creating trusts in this country. What is driving this interest? Do different considerations apply if an NRA has U.S. beneficiaries or if he or she might emigrate to the U.S.? What factors are important to NRAs in selecting a state to house their trusts?
I think most of the activity we're seeing, we're seeing quite a bit of it, is really just an indication of what's sort of happened with the world community. I mean, we're seeing a whole generation of clients now who are U.S. residents who are children of foreigners. They either came here to go to school and they decided to stay, or they came here for their first job and built their careers here, and their families are still abroad. And many of those are very wealthy families. So now you're faced with the transition of wealth from the foreigner to the U.S. beneficiaries. And, you know, we get calls all the time, well, you know, my dad plans to give me $1 million. That's great. So what happens? If father, probably not subject to gift tax in home country, can deposit the $1 million in the kid's account, and what do you got? But now, from that point on, kid pays income tax on that money. From that point on, it's part of the kid's estate, subject to estate tax and GST and everything. In contrast, you can say to the client, well, you know, your dad could create a trust for you. If we do it right, you know, nobody will pay income taxes on the income on the trust. You can even control the trust, and the distributions you take out during your dad's lifetime won't be subject to income tax. It won't be part of your estate when you die, and generation skipping tax doesn't apply, so you can leave it for forever without sharing anything with the U.S. government. With that alternative, why would anybody take the gift outright if they could have that structure at their disposal? And that's what's happening. Now, that structure works whether or not it's a U.S. trust or a foreign trust that that foreigner is creating. But we are quite right. We're seeing much more interest in that scenario to having that be a domestic trust rather than a foreign trust. And I think, you know, the reasons I think we're seeing that are one, the throwback rules that apply to foreign trusts that accumulate income after the grantor dies can be pretty severe if you accumulate income after the grantor dies. And it almost forces you to distribute income currently to the U.S. beneficiaries. And if you're going to do that, then there's no reason, you might as well have had a U.S. trust and paid as you went and kept the sort of creditor protection and so forth in the trust structure rather than forcing distributions. I think also we're finding that the U.S. beneficiaries, you know, feel a little more comfortable having their advisors and their trustees sort of close by. They like to be able to visit their money and sit down and talk with somebody. And it's harder to do that when you have a foreign trust. And I think there's a wrong realization that there are a lot more choices in terms of fiduciaries here, and probably lowers the expenses of running things. Foreign trusts can be expensive and harder to deal with. So I think that's what we're seeing. I mean, in terms of choosing jurisdictions here, I think the primary selection is local taxes. We want a jurisdiction that does not have local taxes on that trust, that we're confident it's not going to pay tax now or in the future. So we shy away from jurisdictions that have high tax rates on trusts or likely to impose them. And then the second choice is places that don't have a rule against perpetuities, because the nice thing about these trusts is the generation skipping tax doesn't apply. So it can run forever. And clients who buy into the program want the same opportunities for the next and future generations, and they don't want to hear that, you know, in 100 years it's got to end. That'll be here before you know it.
Pam, Jack, any thoughts on?
I'm just wondering, as I sit here as a guest of Wilmington Trust Company, whether there are any jurisdictions that have really attractive income tax rules and no rule against perpetuity. But I can't think of any right off the top of my head.
We try.
Leading question.
Ms. Schneider, are you recommending trusts to your clients? Why? Does the size of the estate matter?
yes, I'm recommending trust to my clients, and yes, the size of the estate generally matters. Small, if an estate is really small, I guess they're probably not my client, and number one, and number two, I'm not recommending a trust to them, but otherwise, absolutely. I guess you would divide the reasons for trust, and everybody here knows this, into two very broad categories, tax reasons and non-tax reasons. And again, as I think I said before, when we were talking about just basic estate planning, the non-tax reasons for trusts are very significant in all these cases. Most common reason is the beneficiary is too young to handle property. You want creditor protection, or as I once heard somebody refer to it more accurately, as predator protection. You're talking about potential spouses that your poor, unsophisticated child might become involved with. Also, I think control, ultimate disposition, Q-tip trust for spouses, there are just numerous non-tax reasons, and then once we have those non-tax reasons, again, we tweak it to create our tax reasons, which include lifetime planning, the grads, the dynasty trust for generations giving purposes, various spousal trusts. I think one issue in terms of trust in the future that has really one hot new issue that is very frightening as to what we're going to do is this tendency or this trend that has come up to patent estate planning techniques. And I don't know how we are all going to continue coping with this, but there is one popular estate planning technique, actually most of you know this, but in case anybody doesn't, that has been patented, and it is the use of a grant for stock options. And there is a lawsuit pending for patent infringement on this technique. And I think that as we go forward as estate planners, it is going to be our job to go onto the U.S. Patent Office website and see what patents there may be for techniques that we want to get involved in. Because as those people who are familiar with patent law will tell you, it's not that you would necessarily lose the case for patent. It's that it's going to cost you $1 million in legal fees to fight it. And so you really have to be careful about what you're doing in this area. And it is relatively new. It was a, I guess, relatively recent case where the patent, where it was decided that this business methods patent was possible. And the patent office has actually opened up a new category for aggregating tax strategies, patents, as they're talking about. And so I went on the website today just to take a look and see what there is under this. And I have to say most of the tax strategies for which patents have already been granted include computer programs and such things. And in fact, the big one is what they call this SOGRAT, stock options grant, that really has become a problem. Because as I understand it, once somebody has a patent, they don't have to license it to you. They can just sue you for patent infringement. So we as attorneys practicing can't necessarily, we just can't use that technique. We can't call this person up and say, we want to use your technique, what are you going to charge us to do it? We just can't do it, or we face a lawsuit, and that's what's happening with the stock options grant, just a plain grant with stock options. In terms of grants pending, I came across a very interesting one that I thought I would read to everybody and see if you have any idea what this might be. This is the description of the technique that is being patented. Method by which an individual can manage his own selected assets, receive the benefits from the selected assets, and protect the selected assets from claimants. That's all that this says. There's a number. This was patented. This is a 2005 number. It is a waiting to be granted patent. And the person who filed for it is not listed. So it's really something we have to keep an eye on, and it is a hot issue now, and Congress is legislating, and the IRS is not happy with this either. But in terms of estate planning in the future, this is a major issue for us all, I think.
Pam and Frank, I wonder, obviously we all recommend trusts a lot for all the reasons you've described, tax and non-tax. Sometimes people come in and say, I don't want one for myself or my children because they have some story about a trust that is completely inflexible, completely, there's something about that trust that makes them it makes it anathema to have a trust going forward. I think one of the, and I'm interested in your comments, I think one of the things that's happening is that the flexibility of trusts now is so dramatically different. That is, the routine ability to remove and replace trustees, the conversion of income into total return, the addition of advisors and other non-trustee fiduciaries who are making decisions, the routine way in which people are granted powers, both inter vivos and testamentary. It's kind of not your grandfather's trust anymore. So to some extent, I think the, no pun intended, I think the evolution of flexibility has made them even more attractive in a non-tax and tax environment.
Well, I think it's an education process for your clients, because they do come in with a preconceived notion of what a trust means, that you have, you know, the stodgy trustee who won't give you any money for your Ferrari and, you know, your stuff. You know? And that's not what they want. And so it becomes an education process.
It's not your clients want their kids to get the money for the Ferrari.
But I think, you know, that it becomes an education. And we're finding that, you know, you educate the clients, they realize the benefits of it, and they go forward with it.
Mr. Terrell, are your clients interested in protecting gifts and inheritances from their children's creditors and future spouses? If so, what do you recommend to provide that protection?
You know, it's ironic in a way that this question is coming around in 2006. All of us have had the experience with quite old trusts under documents drafted kind of early in the 20th century and perhaps before, in which all daughters were tied up in exactly this way. You know, the will that says my sons get it outright and my daughters get it in trust in some fashion, with none of the flexibility that we have now. And then over a period probably from, well, during the 30 or so years that all of us really have been practicing, there was kind of an evolution toward, I think, more openness and flexibility, so that I wrote for years and years the 25-30-35 trust for people who might have given each of their children $1 million or $2 million. And the analysis was, well, you know, 25 out of school, 30 finished with your first marriage, 35 if you're not smart with money, you never will be. And I'm sure I've said that, and all of us have said something like that a lot of times. Now the evolution, I think, has swung back, and part of it is the increasing estate tax exemption, and therefore each estate leaves more available for the children, so each amount is a greater amount. Part of it is later marriages, later childbearing, multiple marriages, the tort revolution, all of these sorts of things. So now I'm at a point where, and actually some of my partners who are here will laugh at this, because I've been the 25-30-35 guy for a long time at my firm, that by and large, above a certain amount per child, we are in trust for life, or recommend in trust for life for the child. Now, it can be very flexible. But the main purpose of that trust, I mean, yeah, there's generation skipping exemption and theoretical transfer tax benefits off in the future, 40 years from now. But the main purpose of those trusts now is largely creditor and spousal driven. And, you know, one can write a trust in Pennsylvania, notwithstanding the changes from the Uniform Trust Code that was effective, what, yesterday or the day before, that make third-party trusts a little bit more available statutorily in Pennsylvania than they used to be. That is, for certain kinds of domestic creditors. But by and large, for tort and contract creditors, third-party trusts are completely safe, notwithstanding powers of appointment, notwithstanding powers of invasion. If you can withdraw and it lapses, it's treated as a self-settled trust and it's not safe. Look at the Uniform Trust Code and what it does to third-person trusts. The reality is that a trust for life is largely safe from the claims of creditors, and that's probably true in every state. Spousal creditors is kind of a funny one, because we all know that marital property does not include inherited assets, including gifts, but it does include appreciation. The real problem, of course, with outright distributions is clutter. Our kids get these assets outright and they go into joint names, or they're put into the pay down of the mortgage or a vacation home or whatever, and it starts to look like marital property. So we have to say, when they come in, well, I want a trust to protect from creditors, you can say, well, there are other ways to do it, pre- or post-nuptial agreements, other sorts of exceptions to marital property. But by and large, a trust created by parents for children and grandchildren is pretty darn safe from the claims of creditors. So are clients interested in this? I think this, as Frank said earlier, is a matter of education. But I think we have to say to our clients, who are at this point leaving more and more to their children as the taxes go down, and in some cases quite a bit, there are options between outright at age 18 and in trust forever. And when you're on the in trust forever side, you have to talk about creditors, including spouses. I don't know what percentage of what we draft now is trust for life and perhaps further generations, but it's certainly significantly higher than it used to be.
But you know, ours is 100% in trust for life.
The Mirabello-Blotmacher rule is 100% in trust for life.
100%.
And Jonathan makes a very, Frank will make the same pitch, and it's appropriate that as long as you let the child be a trustee or have a, an important role in the operation of the trust, and as long as the trust can be used to acquire personal use assets, and as long as the invasion powers are proper and the inter vivos and testamentary powers of appointment are properly drafted and so forth, you know, why not? Why not? Well, some people still say, you know what, I want my kid to take those business risks at age 35. So the we're not at the 100%. I think an equally interesting question, Dick, and this isn't what you asked me, but I think you've given me a little permission to do this, is what you would refer to as first-person asset protection, and that is, are my clients interested in protecting their own assets from the claims of their creditors? Not so much spouses, because that's
careful,
really...
Careful, we might be infringing on this.
On a patent, right?
It's not granted.
Yeah. You guys are recording this, right?
Well, absolutely.
I'm Frank Mirabello, and I, some of you know who are members of the American College of Trusts and Estate Council that ACTEC recently started a new committee called the Asset Protection Committee. Actually, the name hasn't been agreed on yet. Somebody suggested it should be the Cover Your Assets Committee. We're still working on a name, but it's the evolution of kind of self creditor protection is something that's going on quite a bit. And Dick, you've been very involved at Wilmington Trust and generally in Delaware in the creation of the Delaware self-settled asset protection statute. There are now, I think, 8 states, perhaps 9.
Arguably nine.
I was in Tennessee last week, and Tennessee's about to introduce one in the legislature. They're kind of anxious to get one down there. The whole idea of people having the ability to live with their assets and have the use of their assets, but at the same time have them not exposed to the claims of creditors is something that I think is increasingly important. And is relevant in what Pam said earlier, which is the non-tax aspects of estate planning, which will be greater and greater, not less.
I think everybody comes in concerned about that. I mean, we're the most litigious society in the world, and they know, if for the grace of God, could be me as a defendant in that lawsuit. And they all come in trying to figure out how they're going to preserve their wealth. And the problem is when you start going through with them, the real costs of doing it, which are primarily the loss of control over the asset, they back off. And they say, well, I'll just buy a bigger Chubb umbrella, you know, this month or something. I mean, they're and I think the inroads give them caution, too. You know, you have bankruptcy law that gets passed, and suddenly the things you thought were safe may not be safe. So it takes a special client. We do quite a few of them, but it takes a special client. I mean, most of the clients we've done them for are people who take a little nest egg, and they say, you know, I'm not really going to need these assets. I don't have to call up my banker and ask him to send me, you know, $50,000 from that account. But if all hell breaks loose, I'd like to know there's something there that I can fall back on, and they don't really need access to it currently. And those are the people we're tending to do it mostly for.
In Pennsylvania, we're blessed with very good creditor protection rules that don't require the creation of self-settled trusts. I mean, our entireties is the best in the nation. Notwithstanding a little bit of breakdown in entireties in the tax area, it's for married clients, which includes three of the four panelists. That's a great technique. But Frank, you're not getting a Chubb policy for an excess malpractice claim. You're limited by the CAT fund. And you're probably not getting a Chubb policy for most kinds of environmental claims. And yeah, maybe you have D&O insurance as a director of a public company, but there are limits on those too, and the liability can be boxcar. The Arthur Anderson partners were not insured on their excess liability. So, yeah, I agree. I'd rather not have clients create self-settled trust that they need. It's really like Pam's comment about partnerships. Put something in an asset protection trust that you never have to ask for, but it's something that clients are interested in, particular kinds of clients are interested in talking about, and I suspect that will be true more and more.
But, you know, just to come full circle, it's interesting because when we were talking about the non-tax reasons and this being one for the third-party trust, for the trust you create for your children or grandchildren or whatever, I find that one of the most compelling arguments to people about that is the fact that that there are issues with doing this for yourself. There are these strict rules you have to follow, there are the particular states you have to go to, some people want to go offshore. Wouldn't it have been nice if your parents had done this for you? That creating this third-party asset-protected trust for your children is really a wonderful gift. I mean, not to get corny about it, but it is a wonderful gift you can give your child. It's a safety net that creates a level of security that they might not otherwise have.
You're giving them a structure that allows them to protect themselves from third parties, which they can't do for themselves. I mean, this is
something that is going to be important even if the estate tax is going to disappear tomorrow, which we don't think it will. But the truth is, as somebody said to me, that they can repeal the estate tax, but they can't repeal greed. They can't repeal a need for credit to protect things from creditors, and they're not going to repeal family fights. So estate planners will always be in business.
Any other comments?
Yeah, Jack, you beforehand were commenting on some discussions with the IRS. Is that something you'd care to share?
We're all aware of the death tax repeal debate and or modification debate, which has failed a number of times to muster the appropriate number of votes in the Senate. And I've shared with Dick and the other panelists a telephone conversation I had today with an IRS attorney who was examining an estate tax return I filed earlier this year. And he had sent a letter about 3 weeks ago requesting a bunch of stuff, you know, that usual letter where you look at it and think, man, I hope we can find these things. It had to do with financial statements of some closely held businesses in the estate. It wasn't a terribly big estate. It's $6 or $7 million. There is some tax at stake, a typical kind of examination. We had just gathered the information, actually had finished gathering it today, when this estate tax attorney, familiar to many of you, called me and said, hey, listen, I've got good news for you and bad news for me. Yeah, what's that? He said, well, the good news for you is that we've withdrawn the examination of your estate tax return. We're just not going to do it. We're going to issue a closing letter. Well, that was good news. And, you know, my client actually jumped up and down. It was charming when she brought the materials in this morning. It was an actual up and down jumping. The bad news was that this gentleman and at least one other colleague will be retired on January the 1st. And that the politicians who are running the Internal Revenue Service have said to these people, these estate tax attorneys, familiar to many of us, listen, go through your list and dump the ones that you don't think are going to accomplish much by way of revenue. Send them a closing letter, withdraw your examination. You're going to be limited to just a very few. And by the way, you've got 6 weeks to close those few. What does it mean? Is it a backdoor effort to repeal the tax? Obviously, the election yesterday doesn't affect the bureaucracies, the Treasury, or the Internal Revenue Service, at least yet. But it was a kind of, I found, disturbing, as a citizen, disturbing situation, because this return deserved to be examined. And it now won't be.
Cried out for examination.
Cried out for examination.
I'd like to thank the panelists and turn it back to Carol.
Thanks, Dick, and thank you very much to our panelists for a very lively and interesting discussion. It's very clear that estate planning survived the election and will survive our new Congress and whatever else it has to offer. We really appreciate your sharing your wisdom and experience, and in Jack's case, confessions. And we thank you again for coming out to hear all of this knowledge and experience.
This recording of the Future Vision of Estate Planning is copyrighted by Wilmington Trust Corporation and used with Wilmington Trust's permission. Further reproduction without permission is prohibited. Lineberg Information Services, Inc., Lizzie, is deeply appreciative and would like to particularly thank Dick Neno, Managing Director and Trust Counsel at Wilmington Trust, for allowing Lizzie to record and share this most important seminar.